writers.
Good afternoon. You've got Living Writers on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm T. Hetzel, and today so happy to have Sandra Cisneros here right in the studio.
Still living.
And still discoing here in the moment. I mean, we're at mid-October. You know, what is it? 2024 now.
Yes. Love that song. That's the song from that I'm planning when I get cremated. That song.
And why, so how did this one, because of the Inferno, or it's why
burn,
this one, Sandra?
Burn. I just thought that was appropriate, and it's one of my favorite songs.
And will the will it be a pyre, like will you be out on a beach, and will you be burning?
Or, no. I just invite a few friends to be there, wherever it is, who knows? But I thought it would be wonderful to have one of my favorite songs. It's very, the lyrics are very appropriate. Yet, don't you think?
Yes, and to have folks dancing too.
Dancing and laughing and telling stories. You know, we buried my dog Beto, and we invited the neighbors who knew him, only people who knew him, and we had tacos and donuts and coffee and orange juice and champagne, and it was the best funeral. And I said, oh, I want something like that.
That sounds really...
Yeah.
Sorry about Beto.
Oh, Beto's still been seen walking around my kitchen, so you know, he's not leaving anytime soon. He's waiting for me.
And on your website, you have a section where you have you have homages. Like
Yeah. I write obituaries as a way of grieving, because if you think about your animal spirits, you know, you have to honor them. And think about, like, if you had to write something for the New York Times to understand their role in your life. And it's the most difficult time to write it because you're very tender and grieving, but it's the best medicine to write an obituary for your pet as if it was going to be published in the New York Times. And you get quotes from friends, and you say, who are the survivors? And you put some anecdotes. And then you understand what their purpose in your life was, and you celebrate. And it's really a wonderful exercise. So sometimes I post them on my website, and I have a whole collection, a whole archive of my animal obituaries, and maybe I'll publish them one day.
Possibly. I think you should. Yeah.
Well, I haven't done it because I thought, oh, people think it's goofy and won't respect, you know, something I know, that they animals, you know, are here for spirit purpose, and that they continue to guide and follow us after death until it's our time and help us to cross over.
And that's really clear from what you've posted on the website.
Yes. Well, I'm an intuitive, and I've been acknowledging that now that I'm older. That's not something I knew about myself. I mean, I knew it, but it wasn't that clear to me that that's what I was until now that I'm 69.
And Sandra, when you say intuitive, like... and intuitive. Is that part of when you were able to see like the spirit of Beto in the kitchen? Is that what you mean too?
Yeah.
Or is it more of a feeling?
Yes.
Or
that too.
Visual.
It's dreams, and it's sometimes visions of the future, and it's sometimes people that are dead that visit you in the waking sleeping or when you're awake. Or sometimes I can't control it. I'm not like really good at it. It's just like, you know, a radar disc, and you know, sometimes you get you know, Darfur, and sometimes you get Havana, and you don't know what's going to come through. And but now I acknowledge it. And whereas when I was younger, I just thought, oh, no, you know, that's not real, or I think that was a dream. Mm. Whereas now I know, oh, okay, let me acknowledge that this is happening and understand that the dream is coming as a visit or as a message. And that's because I have people in my life who are helping to teach me how to use this gift. But everybody has this gift. I'm not special. Everyone has this gift, but people don't practice it. You know, it's like you're born with gifts of intuition. And the artist practices using it by making art. And making art opens that channel. Maybe someone might practice it by meditating. Maybe someone might practice it by working in the garden or working with animals. Maybe someone working in a forest and, you know, talking to the trees. So we all have it, but it's something like, imagine like if you had this wonderful gift of being swift of foot, but you didn't know it. And so you never enter a race, so you don't develop it. And it's like that. Everybody has this gift. We're born with it. But if you don't practice or know that it's there, you're not going to win any races.
And it seems also, since you're mentioning now, as you get older, it feels different to you. Maybe you're not fearing it anymore.
I think it's because I live in Mexico, where there's a very different attitude about the death and the dead. And we're very present with our spiritual awareness. I think countries that are the poorest in the world are the richest spiritually. Isn't that so? Communities that are the poorest have a very intense relationship with their spirit gifts, their spiritual awareness. And I think sometimes when the developed nations that are moved very far away from their connection to the earth don't... I think of them as being spiritually unevolved.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's a kind way to put it.
consumerist evolved, very consumer evolved, but not of maybe the spirit and being open.
Well, you know, I am an only daughter in a family of six sons. And I tell my brothers, you know, oh, this happened or this is going to happen. Or you should go see a doctor because I got a dream. And they think I'm a little crazy. But I don't care because I'm not here to convince anybody. I know what I know. And if you want to listen to me, fine. And if you don't believe in that, that's because you haven't experienced it. And I understand that because everybody's on a different spiritual path. I don't mean religious. I mean about the awareness of the spiritual world. Everybody's on a different path. And so I'm not here to proselytize. I'm just here to report what I know. And if it helps you, great. And if it doesn't, that's fine, too.
Because, you know, everybody in their own time, too.
In their own lifetime.
Yes. Or depending. And that means different things to different people,
yeah,
too.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. We're not on a race competing against each other. We're just like each of us are on a spiritual path, whether we're aware of it or not, and we're in different dimensions, and so it's like it's not a hierarchy.
When you were a kid, what was it like for you with art and the spirit?
Yeah, you know, I had dreams, and I could sense a great communion with nature, with trees especially, and with animals, and you know, but that was not something I thought that was uncommon. I thought everybody could feel that. And I didn't know that what I was experiencing was unique. I dismissed a lot of things that I felt because, you know, when you're with a family who, like my mom, you know, she would just say, oh, you know, you're dreaming. And I learned to keep a lot of things secret because they were very valuable to me. You know, my time communicating with plants and animals, you know, was something so private and uplifting and made me so happy. And plus, I spent a lot of time alone, which is what you have to do to get in touch with your intuition. You know, artists are introverts and we spend time alone. And that's the best training to open up that channel to our highest self, to be able to listen to music and understand its power, and to, you know, go watch the stars and, or to walk in nature or to communicate intuitively with any animal. You know, all of that are gifts that artists have, and sometimes autistic children, which sometimes I think we're on the borderline of that world as well as artists, that there's something, we're blessed and cursed to have this gift and feel things so deeply, to be hypersensitive. And our role, I think, is to translate for those who don't have it.
In Woman Without Shame, your latest book of poems out in 2022, Sandra, you write in the acknowledgments about like having these poems with you for a very long time, and that it was time to let them go. And that's how you end the note. But you start it with saying, I've never stopped being a poet. Yeah. I've always been a poet.
Yes.
Maybe the house on Mango Street had, in a way, the stories seem to maybe overshadow that. That's what, in your own words, like with, but I would say these are poems, the house on Mango Street.
Well, you know, House on Mango Street was written when I was in the poetry workshop at the University of Iowa, and I really was having a hard time there. I felt that my perspective, my voice, and my physical being was not one that was accepted. And I shut down. I censored myself and didn't talk for semester, for all the semesters I was there, the two years. But I was talking in my poetry and in a little side project that I started a second semester, first year, called The House on Mango Street, which was at that time autobiographical vignettes. And it was something I wrote as a way to channel my anger, because I felt very angry that I'd never seen my community written about with love. I'd never seen my life or girls like me or people of color written about with love in the books that I had been educated with. And here I was in my MFA program and, you know, getting ready to finish my education, and I'd never seen myself in these books. And I said, well, I'm going to write that book.
Yes.
So, but I was in the poetry workshop, so I wrote these vignettes as a way to sustain myself, as a way to keep alive, a way to stop buzzing. My phone is buzzing. You know, stop that. Stop that scam. Like, I can't talk right now. I'm on the radio. Okay. Well, you know, I just felt when I was in graduate school that what I had to say wasn't valuable. I was made to feel that it wasn't valuable.
And was that wasn't, well, let me ask, was that because we also, before we came on air, you mentioned that that's where you met Joni Harjo.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine that she wasn't valuing you.
Oh, no, so no. She's the one that was like older sister that took care of me.
Like a lifeline of sorts.
She was my life raft, too, yeah. Because we both felt ostracized and odd in the Iowa Writers' Workshop at that time, which was, you know, not a friendly place. And I feel that if Joy hadn't been there, maybe I wouldn't have stayed and finished my degree and written my manuscript and written my book.
And that's the 40th anniversary.
Now it's the 40th anniversary of its publication. But I started it in Iowa City when I was 22 years old, and I finished it thanks to an NEA grant when I was 28. When I was living in Greece. So big journey from Iowa to
yes.
Greece, and in between working in the Pilsen community in Chicago and collecting stories from my students that I wove into this autobiographical street that became the House on Mango Street and is now the opera that I'm here in Ann Arbor to showcase tomorrow with the composer Derek Bermel. So it's been a long journey from writing those stories when I was feeling silenced at Iowa, and then collecting them as a high school teacher and feeling very powerless, as many high school teachers do, and thinking, oh, you know, what am I going to do with the stories these students are sharing with me? And they have such horrible lives and such tragedies. and, you know, kids that are getting beat up on their way to school because of gangs.
Sandra, this was in Chicago?
Yeah, Chicago, or kids beating up each other, or lovers beating up each other, or parents beating up children. You know, I just, there was a lot of violence and sadness and tragedy in the lives of my students. And I didn't know how to save them. So I just collected their stories and wove them with memories of people I knew, relatives I knew, my own stories, and it became a fiction instead of memoir. And that's how House on Mongastery came out, from a very powerless time in my life. And sometimes we don't realize that we're planting seeds, that we may not see them in our lifetime, but we have to be very mindful about the seeds we're planting, that, you know, it may take a lifetime or seven generations, we don't know, but we have to be mindful today about the seeds we plant. And I think when we create something with puro amor, with pure love, y amor puro, yeah, it always turns out well. House on Mongo Street was not an overnight success. It came out when I was 30, and it didn't really start to take off until I was almost 40. So people have to remember, when you're creating something, that you have to be patient. And I was amazed that the book started taking off, you know, when 10 years later, poco a poco, slow by slow. And then now, 40 years later, that I'm witnessing the opera, its new evolution as House on Mongo Street, the opera. And I'm here at the University of Michigan, where I used to teach as a guest professor at the American Studies Department back in the early 90s. So it's pretty remarkable for me to be back here in this town, where I was offered a job, where I was offered tenure. And I remember telling the dean, you know, tenure isn't a plum for an artist. I said, what are you offering me to walk away from my desk?
And this was early 90s?
Yeah. You know, he was offering me tenure. And I thought, well, I don't want tenure. What are you giving me that I will walk away from my writing desk? Right. And he said, you can really earn this with your writing? I said, yes. And 10 years a shackle for an artist. It's not a plum.
But that was a brave thing for you to
have a sense.
Yeah, it
was very, very brave for me to say. I don't know why I felt so confident, but I did. And I just knew. I guess it was my intuition stepping in again. I said, yeah, you know, what else are you offering me? Because 10 years is not attractive to an artist. I need to have something more that will make me give up my writing and come to teach. And he said, oh, we've had the same issue with a composer. You know, we don't know what to offer a composer either. And I said, no, well, thank you, but no thanks. And so sometimes I think, did I make the right choice? I think I did.
And how do you know that? Because of the life you've lived?
Yeah, it hasn't always been easy. I mean, sometimes it's easier than some years, you know, but it's been very joyous and rewarding, and I get to do collaborations like with Derek Bermel, and I just feel I've written more books than if I had stayed here, and I travel many places, and more than anything, I've grown spiritually, you know, from where I was back in the early 90s. I've learned so much about myself and the world and the work of service I can do into communities, and through my art and through my presentations. So I feel like I'm on a journey. I'm traveling, and I want to serve as best I can the community I come from, and be an instrument for making and creating peace before I graduate into my next lifetime.
This is wonderful. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back with Sandra Cisneros, The House on Mongo Street. And it's the 40th anniversary, and Sandra is in town for a workshop presentation of an opera this week. And we'll talk more about it when we come back. We also have Poems on the Table with us, Woman Without Shame. I'm T. Hetzel. We've got Jason behind the glass. We'll be back.
traveling, 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 looking for something. What can it be? Oh, I hate you some, I hate you some, I love you some.
Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, I'm so glad you did. Today on the program, Sandra Cisneros is here, and we've just heard Joni Mitchell. And thanks, Sandra, for choosing songs for today's program.
Oh, so much fun.
And Jason finding them, Disco Inferno on the fly to start us off, which was just a great energy boost, I think, yeah. For this Wednesday, mid-October. And now Joni on the journey.
Yeah, on the journey. And Joni as of the poet. You know,
yes.
Joni Mitchell, extraordinary writer and inspirational today, to yesterday and today.
And tomorrow, always.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes. Before we get back to the conversation, Sandra, I'll read your bio.
Okay.
In Woman Without Shame, the book of poems on the table with us, out in 2022 from Vintage. Sandra Cisneros was born in Chicago in 1954, internationally acclaimed for her poetry and fiction, which has been translated into more than 25 languages. She is the recipient of numerous awards, including NEA fellowships in both poetry and fiction, a MacArthur Fellowship, the Texas Medal of the Arts, the Penn Nabokov Award for Achievement in International Literature, and the National Medal of Arts. And also the 2022 Ruth Lilly Prize in Chicago. She has fostered the careers of many aspiring and emerging writers through two nonprofits she founded, Macondo Writers, celebrating its 27th anniversary in 2022, and the Alfredo Cisneros del Moral Foundation, which operated for 15 years. As a single woman, Cisneros made the choice to have books instead of children. Her literary papers are preserved at the Whitliff Collections at Texas State University. Currently, she lives in San Miguel de Allende. Cisneros is a dual citizen of the United States and Mexico and earns her living by her pen.
I had that bio written because I, as a young woman, would study bios by the women writers that I admired, and I would ask myself, how did they get the money to do this? You know, how did they manage to steal away the time to get this manuscript together? How did they do it? And I couldn't get a clue with the ones that said they were married to so-and-so or the mom of this person. I felt it was important, and I remember asking my class here in Michigan, in Ann Arbor, my class, what do you want to see when you open a book and look at a writer's bio? And we discussed it, and I felt dissatisfied by the model, so I decided, I'll just write how I became able to free myself to create these pages. I thought that was important to write that down. So that's what I try to include to inspire other younger women to know, okay, I earn my living from my pen. It's possible.
It's a powerful phrase.
Yeah. I never dreamed that it would be possible, but my life is more astonishing than my imagination.
It seems, though, as an outsider who's been thinking about your life for a little while now, preparing for our conversation, that there are moments that you must have known. You mention a couple of them in the acknowledgments where you talk about a teacher in elementary school, I think. Recognizing you, maybe believing in you before you realized it was special. Or I know you said earlier, people have the ability and it's about being open to it.
But you have to practice it, you see? So sometimes we get those little laser beams of possibilities, but we don't pay attention. And I remember when I was in the sixth grade, taking a look in the library card catalog, which at that time was not on a computer. It was through these little drawers, if you remember. These little drawers.
I remember them well.
Yeah, I love them. I love this. They have a little hook. You'd pull them out. They were longer than your arm.
And the physicality of it, right?
And you had to touch each card to look up something. And I remember stumbling upon a card that was grimy and worn out and soft from people's hands. And I stopped and said, this must be a good book. And this little light bulb went off in my head. And I thought, yeah, that's what I want. I can see a dirty card with my name on it. And I see a book with the spine has my name. It's in the library. A lot of people are touching it. And that's what I want. And I tell children when I visit their classrooms, I said, put your finger between your eyebrows. There's a third eye there. Plant that seed of what you want. And I give you permission to dream big. You don't have to tell anyone, but you have to walk towards that dream every day. You know, you have to think it, and you have to walk towards it every day.
And then that card became the house on Mongo Street.
Yes, it did. So I had that clairvoyant moment then, but I didn't know that I was a clairvoyant. I just thought, oh, I see it, and you know, and that's what I want. You know, I didn't have what I wanted on the menu, but I could see it in my mind's eye. And I think sometimes we don't know sometimes that we could ask for things that aren't on the menu, right?
Completely.
Yeah.
Completely.
And for me, you know, coming from where I came from, a very poor neighborhood, my father was an upholsterer. My mother was the mom of seven kids. You know, they couldn't help me to become a writer. But in a way, they did, because both of them were very driven about their children getting an education. My mom gave me the best advice, and that is earn your own money, even and especially if you're married. Earn your own money. And that's advice I give to young audiences all the time. I have three. One, earn your own money. Because if you earn your own money, you can lead the life you want to live. You have independence. So I tell children, stay in school longer so you'll earn more. Earn your own money. And number two, control your fertility. Girls and boys need to know that, because you don't want to have children when you're a child. It could veer you off your brilliant career. And I tell girls, especially, you know, especially now when that right to control your own body is being taken away from your culture or your religion or your politician, you need to control your own body. So control your fertility. That's number two. And then number three, which I didn't realize was so astonishing to young people, and that is solitude is sacred. It's okay to be alone. It's okay to not have the phone on or look into who's calling you, who likes you, who doesn't like you. How about if you take some time out and use that time to nurture yourself and to become the person you want to become? Take that time. The universe is giving it to you as a gift for you to nurture you. And that's essential, because when you're young, you so much want to be a couple, you want to be in love, you want to be invited to the parties, and you don't know that sometimes the universe gives you alone time as a gift, as a wonderful gift for you to become you.
Would you say, Sandra, that connects to your lead poem in Woman Without Shame?
I could read that.
Provincetown, 1982.
Yeah, let me read that poem. It came out of all places in the New Yorker, and I'm not a New Yorker type writer, so it really surprised me when they accepted it. Tea Dance, Provincetown, 1982. At the boy bar, no one danced with me. I danced with everyone. The entire room, every song. That's what was so great about the boy bars then. The room vibrated, shook, convulsed in one collective zoological frenzy. Truthfully, I was the only woman there. Who cared? At the boat slip, I was welcomed. The girl bar down the street? Dull as Brillo. But the tea dances shimmied, miraculous as mercury. Acrid stink of sweat and chlorine tang of semen. Slippery male energy, something akin to watching horses fighting. Something exciting. My lover, the final summer he was by, introduced me to the tease, often hovered out of sight, distracted by poolside beauties, while I danced content, innocent, with the room of men. He was a skittish kite, that one. Kite swerve and swoop and whoop, only a matter of time, I knew. Apropos, I called him my little piece of string, and that's what kites leave you with in the end. There was an expiration date to summer. Understood. That season, I was experimenting to be the woman I wanted to be. Taught myself to sun topless at the gay beach where sunbathers shouted, "Ranger!" A relayed warning announcing authority en route on horseback, coming to inspect if we were clothed, else fined, $50 sans bottom, $100 topless, $50 a tit, I joked. It was easy to be half naked at a gay beach. Men didn't bother to look. I was in training to be a woman without shame. Not a shameless woman, una sin vergüenza, but una sin vergüenza, glorious in her skin, flesh akin to pride. I shed that summer not only bikini top, but guilt-driven Eve and self-immolating Fatima. Was practicing for my Minoan days ahead, Medusa hair and breast spectacular as Nike of Samothrace welcoming the salty wind. Yes, I was a lovely thing then. I can say this with impunity. At 28, she was a woman unrelated to me. I could tell stories, have so many to tell, and none to tell them to except the page, my faithful confessor. Lover and I feuded one night when he wouldn't come home with me. His secret? Herpes. Laughable in retrospect, considering the plague was already decimating dances across the globe. But that was before we knew it as the plague. We were all on the run in 82, jumping to Laura Branigan's Gloria, the summer's theme song, beat thumping in our blood, drinks sweeter than bodies convulsing on the floor.
Thank you, Sandra.
Thanks for asking. I really enjoy reading my own poems. All my books are on audio if listeners would like to hear my self-reading to them. They can get the books on audio.
What is it about that? Like, poems meant to be out in the world, to be heard.
That's right. And there are some paper poems. My poems come from a spoken word, from speech. And I hear them so clearly, and I work very, very, very hard to create music with the syllables. So I want to get it right and perform it for you. So I invite you to hear me on audio.
Sandra, how did you choose, when you were putting together Woman Without Shame, how did you decide the order for this? Why was this the lead poem?
Well, you know, I'm not so fixed about the order, because when I'm putting a book together, I'm more focused on the content. And I listen to my editor Sometimes I will have some vague idea about how things should go. But I don't remember if I chose this poem or he chose this poem. I'm talking about John Freeman at Knopf, whether, you know, we both selected it. Or sometimes I'll give it to other poets and say, what do you think about the order here? What should we do here? So I like to keep an open mind because I feel like when I'm creating, I can't focus on the presentation. I'm working still on revising and making the poems as strong as they can be.
Sandra, let's take another short break, and then when we come back, maybe we'll hear another poem.
Okay.
And maybe The House on Mongo Street.
Okay.
Today on Living Writers, Sandra Cisneros is here. I'm T. Hetzel. We've got Jason behind the glass, and we'll be back.
What's it all about, Alfie? Is it just for the moment we live? What's it all about when you sort it out, Alfie? Are we meant to take more than we give? Or are we meant to be kind? And if only fools are kind, Alfie, then I guess it is wise to be cruel.
Welcome back. You've got Living Writers. Sandra Cisneros is here in the studio. And we just got to hear Cher. Sandra, why'd you choose that one?
Well, I guess if there were any writers that are alive, or singers rather, that I would like to meet, it'd be Cher and Cyndi Lauper. And Cher sang that song when, you know, she wasn't famous Cher. She sang it at the closing credits of the original Alfie movie in the early 60s. And she had just a beautiful voice, and she's there, but, you know, she's not singing the opening credits. It's like they just threw that in as a little bonus, and she became famous later. But I think that interpretation is so heartfelt and beautiful, and it's one of my favorite Cher songs. And
how did you first find it? When did you find it?
Well, I like the movie. I like lots of early movies. I like a lot of old vintage films, and a favorite movie of mine.
And then you were like, oh my
God. I said, that's Cher.
It's Cher.
Yeah, that's Cher. Yeah, that's Cher before Cher became Cher. Yeah.
Was it before Sonny and Cher or before?
She may have known Sonny, but okay. She's not singing on that track.
Thank goodness. No,
No shade on
Sonny.
He helped her hold her hand so she could become Cher. But if you look at the date of that film, it's very early, you know, so before she made a national and international splash.
Oh, completely. Yeah. And then Cyndi Lauper, too.
Cyndi Lauper.
Why is that?
Amazing. She's got a working class background, too. And she did something revolutionary when she made her music video. It was the first time I ever saw women of color in a music video, you know, like that were all together, mixed race women together. Those were her friends that she picked out. And so that was revolutionary for me. I believe that came out in 83. Something like that. If you read her memoir, which is fabulous, you know, you can see the journey that she took as well. And it was that song, Girls Just Want to Have Fun, was so important to me during a very difficult year of my life when I moved to Texas in 84. I would play that on my Walkman and ride my only means of transportation, which was a $25 bicycle, to work, listening to that and riding. And it would give me energy and faith to keep going, because every day I felt like quitting that job. And it was just, you know, just listening to her song that gave me hope and faith that I could brave that difficult year of my life.
What brought you to Texas? Was it that particular
job?
Job,
a job, yeah, and it was a difficult job. I took a job that was director at a community cultural center and literature program, which I was qualified for, but it was a position that several local writers wanted. So there was a lot of fighting, and they brought me in as a dark horse. So all of the factions fought with me. So I'm not a native Texan, and I was always looked at as a carpetbagger. It was really difficult. But I learned a lot. It was a baptism by fire in Texas. And I thought I would stay there for a year and then give my notice and leave. But destiny had other plans. And as I was packing to leave, I won a residency at the Adobe Paisano House outside of Austin for 6 months. And that was as if fate said, no, we're not done with you. That job was for you to come to Texas, but you need to stay here. And it would be my home for almost 25 years. I would come back and forth. I never could find a job in Texas, but I found low overhead during those years from 84 till I moved in the year 2011. You know, I found low overhead. And for an artist, that's important. You need to lower your overhead so you can create your art. And I would go to other states, teach for a semester in Ann Arbor, teach a semester at University of New Mexico, teach at UC Davis, teach at Berkeley, and always bring my money back to Texas and save time so that I could take time off and write. And that's how I wrote a lot of my work.
And you have to have such a vision, like a strong belief in yourself to be able to fight off the pressures of, I think, conforming or stability.
Well, I like to tell audiences that, you know, to be a writer, it's rather inexpensive. You just need a pen and a paper. But I like what Dorothy Allison says, so I'm going to qualify that and say she said it's a very expensive route. And I would agree. You know, maybe the tools are inexpensive, but the cost and the sacrifices you have to make. Sometimes it means you can't afford to have a child. Sometimes it means that your partner will leave you because they don't understand your need for solitude or don't know how to support you during your depressions. They can't bear, you know, your moods. You need to move a lot. You need to make all the sacrifices you would as if you were married to a husband. So the art becomes your husband. And I tell young people, you know, are you willing to make these sacrifices at whatever the cost? And would you still write even if no one read your work and you didn't make any money from your art? Would you still do it? And I think, you know, if you say yes, then you're an artist. If you're doing it to become a wealthy or famous, I don't think wealth or fame will come to you, because powerful art doesn't come from greed or motive. It comes from service. It comes from opening your heart and creating art for love, por puro amor, for amor puro, for people you love, on behalf of them, without any personal agenda. That's the ticket. With no personal agenda, with no ego involved. And you plant seeds when you do it for pure love and without yourself in mind. Sometimes it brings fame. Sometimes it brings money. But it gives you a more luxurious capital. To me, it brings you
the spiritual.
Yeah, something better than money and fame.
Yes. I think I was just so struck by this wonderful, I loved Woman Without Shame. I loved the boldness of that title, and it felt like it was, and the visual that you also include as part of this, because it seemed like to preface talking about things that maybe it took this long for you, this many years,
yeah,
to become.
Yeah.
And we mentioned briefly, like, also this idea of the body.
Yes.
And what we are as human beings, as we're aging, perimenopause, menopause. And yeah, you write about the body.
Yeah, well, you know,
I'm have.
I don't want to be censored. And I mean, my books are censored, but I don't want to censor myself. And I did a lot of censoring when I was young. But now I'm about to turn 70 in a couple of weeks. I don't want to be ashamed to say something, to think something, or to explore things that are taboo for me. And for women, a lot is taboo. You know, a lot is taboo
still,
about still. What we can say, what we can think. And I just feel like I don't intend to be scandalous. I don't intend to shock anybody, but I want to talk about the things that I'm ashamed to talk about so that I can take away the shame. I don't want to censor myself, so I like to have a room in the house of the spirit where I can think anything and say anything. And that's the house of poetry, isn't it? You know, that's what poetry is. It's the room in the house where you can go and think and say anything you want. And it takes you on a journey. Poems are journeys. You know, you have to go on them and see where it takes you, because you think it's about something when you begin and it takes you to someplace else. So I never know what these poems are going to be when I begin. I just know, okay, I feel a little reticent about talking about my body as it's growing older. So let's talk about it then. Let's go there. I have a poem that's new called How to Grow Old that I was inspired by looking at Seneca's writing of how to grow old. And his book is lovely, but I have my own my own rules looking at my body and looking at my neck and how it's changing and looking at the bat wings I'm growing under my upper arms and how when I take a bath, I have this little round mound of pizza dough that's my belly now. It's like, oh, that's amazing, look at that. But then I also give thanks, because what if I didn't have enough to eat? But I do. So all of this, the changes in the body, are fascinating to me, in the same way that when I was a child and I was turning into a woman, the changes in my body were fascinating. So I want to document them. I want to draw them. You know, I want to look at them closely and explore them so that I'm not ashamed.
Mm-hmm. I'm so glad.
Well, you know, I never know where these poems are going to take me, but I know that they're self-portraits in a way, and they give animo, a little zap of fire to readers and women especially who are also going through these changes. Yeah.
And it's important to have that kind of community and know that there's other folks experiencing, so you don't feel like you're an alien in your own body, because yeah, it can feel that way.
And what makes me laugh after I write it, it's not so tragic. I laugh, and
yes,
that's what I want, to be able to laugh at myself. Yeah.
And life, because life is absurd. I mean,
I can't see it any other way, because the alternative is to cry. So it's much better to laugh.
Completely, completely. Could we get in a time machine for a moment, Sandra, mm-hmm. and look at this poem from a much earlier book?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. My Wicked, Wicked Ways. Oh, yeah, that poem is from my first book of the same title, and it's from a photograph looking at myself. But I don't want to read that poem, because it's like looking at my high school yearbook photos.
Oh, no.
So when I look at poems from that time,
we'll take, you know, it away.
It's a book that I acknowledge that I wrote, but it's not my favorite book anymore.
Oh, really?
I know, because I feel I outgrew those poems.
Yes.
You know, those were poems I wrote in my 20s, and I look at those poems and I say, well, that has nothing to do with who I am now.
So what is, so connecting to the house on Mongo Street,
yeah,
how do you feel about
the opera.
The opera and this anniversary of these stories.
Well, you
stories.
Know, if I didn't have the opera, I might feel differently. But because of the opera, I'm excited about the anniversary, because we've revisited the book. We've hammered out a linear story. We've fleshed out characters that came in briefly. We've telescoped. We've created an arc. And we've added a soundtrack that's amazingly beautiful with singers singing the lyrics. So to me, it's joy now to talk about this 40-year-plus project, because the opera is adding a new dimension to it. So I'm thrilled. It will debut next summer at the Glimmerglass Festival, but it's debuting tomorrow night here at Ann Arbor at, I think, 8 o'clock. Do you have that information? It's with composer Derek Bermel and I, and and Jace Algren as the conductor, and student singers singing. And so it's really thrilling. Yeah, it's the performance that we'll see tomorrow night with students from the voice and opera department.
And then also you'll be in Rackham on the 18th.
Yes.
At 7 o'clock for yeah. a conversation as well.
A conversation with Ruth Behar, who's a professor here and
friend of the show.
And been a friend to me.
Oh, since, more importantly.
since I taught here in the early 90s. So we've been very close friends, and it's going to be a wonderful conversation. I want to thank Ashley Lucas, who was originally supposed to interview me, but she caught COVID, and so Ruth Behar will be stepping in instead.
Well, I'm sorry for Ashley, but yes. how lovely, what a lovely moment to yeah. see both you and Ruth sharing the stage there and yeah. talking together. But back to the opera. So what's it like to be a librettist now?
Well,
adding that to the...
I have to clarify and say that I'm the co-librettist with Derek Bermel, because I was supposed to be the librettist, and the composer and I collaborated. It didn't start out that way. I was supposed to do the libretto, but he would come up with such great lines, and I'd say, oh, let's use that. Oh, how about this? So we wound up co-writing much more than we had imagined we would, because Derek's a very good writer, and he's also very funny. So we just play off of each other, and I'll say something, he'll say something, and I'll laugh, and he'll add. So I have to be honest and say it's libretto by Sandro Cisneros and the composer Derek Bermel.
And what a wonderful surprise to have happen, because often when you're writing many of these poems, it sounds like, from talking with you today about your process and finding the solitude and the time, this is a completely different way of being in the house on Mango Street now
yeah.
for you, because it's a collaboration, a true collaboration.
Yeah. If Derek hadn't asked me to do this, I might not have ever imagined I could do this, because he loved the book so much. And I didn't know him. He approached me. I heard his music. And I just felt this is a composer of such profound depth and emotion in his art. And I knew he could do it. And I loved the sample that he sent me. So we've been on what I call a joy ride together. It's been so much fun working together. We're still tweaking. We're still working together. And tomorrow night, when I hear the production done here at the University of Ann Arbor, it's going to be thrilling.
And tonight is a dress rehearsal.
Tonight's
so you'll be heading there next. And
yes.
then tomorrow night is the workshop performance
yes.
of this. Oh,
it's... Yeah. And the debut will be next summer with the whole nine yards with costumes and at the Glimmer Glass Festival in the summer and up in Cooperstown, New York.
That's not long. Oops, that's not long to wait.
No,
not at
not
all.
Long.
It's coming. It's coming down. Well, Sandra, we're in our last moments together too. So, would you like to read?
One more
poem.
Okay.
And then take
yeah.
us out with your last song
yeah.
as we head out.
Yeah, this is a poem that I wrote that later on I realized Javier Zamora had a poem of the same title. And I didn't want people to think that I copied, so I put a footnote that maybe we were writing it at the same time. Instructions for my funeral. For good measure, smoke me with copal. Shroud me in my raggedy rebozo. No jewelry, give to friends. No coffin, instead petate. Ignite to disco inferno. Allow no Christian rituals for this bitch. But if you like, you may invite a homeless dog to sing or a witch woman to spit orange water and chant an Otomi prayer. Send no ashes north of the Rio Bravo on penalty of curse. I belong here, under a Mexican maguey, beneath a carved mesquite bench that says, Ni modo. Smoke a Havana. Music Fellini-esque, above all laugh, and don't forget, spell my name with mezcal.
lovely last image there.
Thank you for having me, T. This has been so much
Sandra,
fun.
Sandra, thank you so much for being here. You know what? I think we have maybe one more minute before we go to the last song. So this is, I've been waiting for this moment. I wanted to talk with you about the dogs, because often we think we could have outtakes of Living Writers about Living Writers and their pets, and especially dogs. So I loved Camacho also on the site. Who is your current pup?
I have four. I like to have four or more, but now I live downtown Mexico, in Mexico, in San Miguel, and I don't have a big yard. I have a terrace. So I used to, in my old life in Texas, rescue animals, or people drop them in my yard. I lived by the river, so there was a lot of rescuing going on, and I would foster. But now I only have four, two Chihuahuas, a Xolo Squinkly, Mexican hairless, and a Dachshund. And the Dachshund is the dog related to the woman who did the cover of my poetry book. That's the Mexican photographer, Flora Garduño, and we're related by Dachshunds.
<That's> Yes. And how did each of them, were these rescues, or how did they come into your lives?
Some are rescues, and some are rescued from just a horrible little hovel that they're being sold in. And the Dachshund was forced on me by Flora Garduño. But I wish I could still rescue, because they rescue me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, dogs are the best. Are they your spirit animal?
Or no, if I could have cats, and if I could have a donkey, I'd be very happy if I could have a donkey. And I would like to be adopted by an elephant. That would be the best.
Sandra, we have some things strangely in common, like with this donkey family member and being adopted by an elephant.
Yeah, doesn't everybody want to be adopted by an elephant?
I mean, you're the only other person I've actually ever heard say this. But why donkeys? How did donkeys come into your life?
I lived in Greece on an island where I finished house on Mongo Street, and the donkeys were the only way of getting up the mountain and carrying things. So I would hear them all the time, and I just fell in love with them and their sad cry and their lovely watery eyes that always look like they were going to break into tears. So I just love them. But I have no place to put a donkey, so I only have donkeys in my poems. That's the best way to keep them when you live downtown.
It is. It is. And the four pups.
Yes. And I have birds, but they are not in cages. They live in the sky and in the mesquite trees, and hummingbirds and owls and sparrows and woodpeckers and, you know, all these
are
birds.
Are they coming every day then?
They're all over. I don't believe in keeping them in cages. So it's just lovely to share the birds of San Miguel and the beautiful environment that it is, of course. And we have monarch butterflies that come down from Canada on their way to Michoacan to winter. So, you know, it's a wonderful place to live with the mountains and the clouds and the sky and the animals very close to you.
It feels like the clouds and the sky are just always a part of your sensibility.
They're in my poems a lot. Yeah.
Yes. And
they're part of my life in Mexico.
And because it's expansiveness. Have you found the place you want to be now?
I think House on Mongo Street predicted that I would find a home in the heart. And I'm like a snail, so my home's in my heart.
And those are the closing lines of the House on Mongo Street. Thank you so much, Sandra Cisneros, being here today on Living Writers.
So fun. Thank you, T.
Oh, thank you. Until next time, everyone. I'm T. Hetzel. Sandra.
All right. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for tuning in. This is WCBN FN Ann Arbor. Thank you for joining us for the Daily Sports Report. A lot to get to today, so we're going to go ahead and get started. I apologize beforehand if my voice kind of sounds raspy. I'm a little under the weather. It's that time of year again in Michigan. Woke up today, 48 degrees. Not great. Not great to see my summer and fall ending. But yeah, so let's get into it. First thing that I was hoping to talk about today, the recent trade news. So two massive trades, I would say, occurred just in the past couple of days. The Jets acquire Davante Adams from the Raiders. Now, as someone who has paid very close attention to the Jets in recent weeks, I'm a Packers fan, so... Packers fan and Aaron Rodgers fan. So I was looking to see how he would do this season, and so far have been a little underwhelmed. Big acquisition for the Jets in terms of getting Davante Adams. In terms of what